the idea of this afternoon was just to have some opportunity to discuss the topics of the week, working on observables and infrared issues, or as we've seen, eternal inflation provides sort of the mother of all infrared issues, so we'll talk some about that. So these are some possible menu items. I guess Don isn't here. There was some remaining controversy back and forth in particular, which
I see him.
Don shows up. He might want to say something about it. We don't have to draft him. There were, at least I think in my mind and others, some questions about these sort of ABM clocks and logs of Bianca's. I haven't heard say a few more words about explaining how those work. And then Ben has more to say, Thomas has more to say, and there could be other things. So
my talk was crystal clear.
There's dot dot dot. So the next thing I was going to say is some of you may have questions for other speakers or other issues you want to raise. So really, it's kind of open. What do people want to talk about? Jim?
Well, let's see. I still have a question for Ben. Right? Is he here?
On the right? Yes.
So there are these people that want to take NA over NB and derive Born's rule in quantum mechanics, namely Gloria Tetmar, Rousseau and Susskind, Brett, and Vienkin, I think, also. Right. So what's your opinion? So we don't have quantum mechanical probabilities, we get them back, counting.
I don't know. Do you have an opinion, Steve? I was sympathetic.
You have an opinion? That's all right. That's enough. We can stop right here.
I was sympathetic to that work, but at least in some versions of it, I wasn't fully convinced that you were deriving Born's rule without putting in some facts about quantum mechanics there. So, in detail, I don't know if I'd be ready to say that they have they've eliminated the need for the Born rule.
You can't derive Born's rule from pure logic. So some assumptions have to be.
Okay.
So what's your take on Don Page's work with the Born rule fails?
Oh, Don Page's, he has Born's, for example, Thomas, let's see. The Born's rule is alive and well for third-person probabilities of what the universe is. If you want to calculate probabilities for observations, then, as Thomas described, you get it's not simply the squares of amplitudes, but the sort of sum over the alternative ways it can be observed. So I don't think there's any problem the way he states it. And furthermore, Don agrees with that. So there's no problem with Born's rule. It's Born's rule is applied to this problem of when we're duplicated in as exactly in physical systems in the very large universes.
But I guess the point is to calculate by third-person probabilities. I guess you mean probabilities for some global situation, right? So you're saying there the Born rule is sufficient.
Global and local, right? It's just the usual story. What is the universe like? However coarse-grained, it locally or globally. Either way, it's Born's rule. Find a wave function, square it roughly, act on it with a projection, ask your question, and square it. You would agree with that.
But at some stage, you guys need to make some further decision about how you're going to translate that into local probabilities.
It could be local, but they you have to take into account that we are physical systems within the universe. And we only have a probability to exist in any one Hubble volume, right? And therefore, if you want to calculate, for example, as Thomas said, in a large universe, you get is favored because there are more places for us to exist. That kind of issue.
Right.
So that you would call that global, I guess. So yes. So I don't think there's a problem at the level he states. It's economic. And I think he agrees, I just didn't get it in writing. Well, I did. Mark, who's here, we wrote a paper on all this.
I did.
Carefully. And we compared with Page in the end, and to make sure we got the, we didn't make any mistakes, we let him write the section.
I think it's just a semantics question of what precisely do you mean by Boren's rule. But there isn't an interesting physics distinction between what Don Page says, Jim and I, or anyone else, I think.
Okay. Well, so that's Boren's rule.
Steve, I'd like to hear some more about this, the connection between firewalls and internal inflation, or the, how the problems coincide. I mean, can you say a few more words about how you see the ideas or the problems fitting together?
I can say briefly. I'm sorry that I, let me just draw a picture.
Maybe if you're going to talk for more than 30 seconds, pick up the microphone.
Okay.
Because we're listed 10 times the report.
My comment was just so the picture I drew before was this issue about this end of time issue. Uh-huh. And how we were being too crude in cutting these things off. So the conclusion there about was that in the context of eternal inflation, there I think what we need to do is we need to extend the description beyond the causal patch.
Right.
Or really, I mean, like, why did we want to focus on one causal patch? Because basically we thought there was a danger that some operator over here and some operator over here might not commute. We might be overcounting degrees of freedom, right? So really this is a question about commutators. And I guess Eva and is calculating these commutators, right? So I think the point is there's I mean, we can actually calculate what these commutators look like.
Wait, right? We're directly calculating commutators. That's what people do with string cutting in the past. But if you want,
you're calculating calculating non-local effects due to string spreading,
right?
And I think if you mean by non-locality what I mean by non-locality. That's related to operators not commuting in space like
separation. No. It's causal. It's perfectly causal. It's
the points would be on the horizon. Not at spatial separation, but there would be two points on the horizon.
So what would you say about operators at these points commuting? You have nothing to say about that, or
nothing direct.
Yeah, nothing direct.
So right, let me
draw. We do a check of whether it's consistent with early and late universe cosmology, and it is. You could question, you have to ask that question.
Yeah.
Because in late universe cosmology, you have a distribution of matter along homogeneous slices, and the matter falls across observer horizons with large relative boosts. And the reason that it's fine with that is simply because the universe isn't old enough to be in the regime where that actually becomes too large.
Right.
So plus there are details about when the spreading is detectable, and that puts a lower bound on the mass of the detector in a context like cosmological horizons. The analog of the Schwarzschild radius is the de Sitter radius, which is absolutely gigantic. So it is consistent with late universe cosmology. It's not predicting some kind of end of time thing like you said there.
No, okay. Let me leave you guys out of it. So my point was, we had, for various reasons, we thought that these degrees of freedom were not independent of these degrees of freedom over here. My only point about it would be nice if we could somehow if we could quantify that better, right? So far we're just kind of using a rule, right? The rule is if you restrict to one causal patch, then you can do effective field theory, and in larger regions you can't.
But let's say there were firewalls. Let's say the worst happens. They're just firewalls. Old black holes have firewalls. I don't know how old you want to take them, whatever you want. What would that say?
Well, I think the firewall is still a violation of effective field theory. So in the black hole case, let's just draw the black hole picture. So the firewall argument involves some Hawking radiation, some partner, right? And these things all fit within one causal patch. Well, I think that's worth calculating more, but let's just say they fit within one causal patch. All right. So then, as long as you believe unitarity, okay, then you have to violate one of the other things. So you either have to violate the equivalence principle, or you have to violate causality, right? You need a non-zero commutator here between these things.
Right, so we're...
So you either have to violate the equivalence principle, which I'll take to be part of effective field theory, or you have to violate causality.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so this is kind of going from the other direction, right? This is saying, even in one causal patch, there's effective field, and even when the energy densities are not high, then due to whatever, large relative boosts or whatever, then there's effective field theory violations. Okay? So I think what this is pointing to is that, black hole complementarity was maybe a good zeroth order, or a good first order idea. It was that, okay, effective field theory will work roughly within one causal patch. But these two problems are telling us that we need to refine that. So there'll be failures even within one causal patch. And I mean, we know kind of from inflation that you can describe things a little bit beyond one causal patch without having major problems. And I think what we need to understand here is, what's the right physical way to understand the fact that these degrees of freedom are not independent of each other? And it's probably not by just hacking off spatial regions.
Sorry, you're asserting they're not independent of each other. Is that clear?
I gave my argument. So the de Sitter entropy is one argument. The fact that they're out of causal contact is another argument. I'm just asserting that the global description of de Sitter of eternal inflation and string theory makes use of more degrees of freedom than you should really be allowed to use.
Well, maybe the stronger argument is what you said, that, if you try to formulate a sensible calculation, if you allow this, ultimately you seem to get into trouble.
That's right. And then sensible people can just say, well, you're calculating the wrong thing. And
they have to say what you should be
doing. Right. Okay. So, one analogy for this is the black hole analogy, where you want to say that or maybe you want to avoid this, but at least one traditional thing to say would be that stuff behind the horizon is not independent of stuff that's in the Hawking radiation.
But suppose we take, as you said, there are two options below the violation of effective field theory. One is a breakdown of the field theoretic, the regular equivalent principle. That's what we're finding can happen in string theory.
Yeah.
How would that play out in your left-hand picture?
Yeah, it's possible that I could adapt something like your argument to argue that these degrees of freedom, if I trace them back, there's some large relative boost or something, but I don't see that. So it's not obvious that that would help with this sort of thing. So in that case, it would be more of an analogy. We need some way of trying to quantify the fact that these degrees of freedom are redundant, are not.
So by the way, Sean Hartwell told me, it's sort of obvious, probably people already thought about this before, but weak, field strengths, weak curvatures are not in conflict with the breakdown of effective field theory for a trivial reason. So here's an example, just a very weak electric field. Permeating space, put a charge there, a pair of charges there, over long times, that can build up a huge energy just by accelerating the electric field, the charged particles. So the weakness of the curvature, it's not that surprising to find a breakdown of effective field theory despite weak field strengths, in this context, weak curvatures, over long times.
You're accelerating it. What is the invariant quantity? That's
two particles.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I guess we have things that vaguely smell like that in this inner space.
And in black holes, you mentioned is a more fancy relative of that, where the trajectories of black hole develop these big juice, but over a long time.
Comment. The violation of effective field theory in small curvature in long times is exactly what doctors used to use in the black hole balances that I described. It's exactly that one.
Yeah, I think there are a number of sort of proposals or suggestions for how effective field theory breaks down, say in the black hole context, and one of our problems is to sort out which one sort of makes sense. There are a number of things on the table. One other perspective on this, though, is that the black hole horizon and De Sitter horizon, in some respects they're similar, in some respects they're somewhat different, right? It's not absolutely clear that whatever is responsible, say, for transferring information out of black hole and unitarizing black hole formation and evaporation is going to be quite the same story.
That's true. Yeah.
Can I make a comment with what you just said?
Sure.
So if you actually take into account the back reaction of particle created in this electric field, right?
I'm not even I'm not doing the Schwinger effect.
Yeah, but if you include it, when you include this, the created charges will eventually move to compensate for the field, and eventually everything will be fine again. So I think that if it takes.
So that depends on the rate for that depends on the masses of these charges. In an abstract theory, not in the real world, where we know.
Eva, you just wonder with gravity turned off, say. Right? You just have electric fields and charges.
Gravity's turned off, but he's asking about the Schwinger effect, I think.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, the back reaction. If you include within your effect field theory description the back reaction, things might become better. That's what I'm saying.
But Schwinger is a non-perturbatively slow process, right? So
it is exponentially spread. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you have a huge volume, so.
Yeah, you can ask how big of.
You still have a long time to accelerate charges.
Yeah.
For the field decays.
But in that example, exactly what's the breakdown? You're saying the particle eventually will get a large center of mass energy or something?
Right, so it's not a huge surprise. I'm just saying the weakness of the fields and the smallness of the initial center of mass energy of the two particles doesn't conflict with the fact that later they develop this big center of mass energy taken from the field, which has infinite energy because it goes over all space, but it's very dilute.
But at that later time, you do specifically see a high energy stuff that is breaking down your theory, which you might not see in, say, in the black hole context.
In the black hole context, we're talking about something that's been known for quite a while, that you take pairs of trajectories separated by times longer than Schwarzschild, and they develop an exponential delta boost. So there is a big center of mass energy there in the center.
If you actually put those particles in, they will break down something.
Well, that's the question is how much that buys you, but the fact that there's a big center mass energy is trivial. It's a consequence of it.
Yeah, there's a big relative boost as a consequence of the fact that, the near horizon space-time being like Rindler space, and people who come in at different times have huge relative boosts.
But that's because the black hole did the acceleration. Rindler space by itself wouldn't accomplish that.
Yeah. But the same thing would happen at the De Sitter horizon, at least if you would put those particles in,
both statements. So if you did the De Sitter horizon and you dropped in particles across it, and, static patch De Sitter time translated times, it would be true. But more to the point in cosmology, it's also true that if you distribute matter along the homogeneous spatial slices and you look at that as an observer, you'll see those things cross with a big relative boost. So, it's again a pretty simple kinematic statement. So, any proposal for dynamics in at the horizon that depends on that effect has to, you know.
But what was your lesson? If you put in matter in a homogeneous way, then...
So just take the center, distribute galaxies along, just to be simple, the global spatial slices.
Yeah.
Take an observer horizon, and, you know, if you're looking at two galaxies that were separated along the spatial slice, they fall across this horizon with a relative boost that is similar to the one in the background.
I mean, it's probably just this statement here that if you do this and this, isn't it?
Well, we've calculated it separately from that, but it turns out to be true. It probably should be obvious. So it's just, you can look at our paper if you want, but you...
Well, I did look at your paper, but I...
No, I mean, this is, I'm just saying the calculations in there, it's pretty, it's fun, it's simple. The statement is just that, if you distribute matter along homogeneous spatial slices uniformly, and you ask how they cross an observer horizon, they cross it with a relative boost.
Yes.
That goes...
Okay, that I understand, but I don't think there's no obvious consequence of that, right? Because there's nothing at the observer horizon.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Until here.
There's matter, right? So there's matter. So these galaxies.
Yeah.
So that's what there is.
But those two galaxies with a large relative boost, they are not colliding in this.
Yes, but
if they would collide with a large relative boost,
strings have non-localities, and that's
a discussion. She's saying this process is like a collision, and that there is a big. If you call those one and two, I think this is the right picture. This is basically what you're saying, right?
Yeah. It's just
And two effectively have a large relative boost in the near horizon.
That's right, and it's true of one and two if you trace them back to the usual situation in cosmology where they're homogeneously distributed as opposed to setting up exactly the thought experiment you would do in a black hole where you sit outside. But, I forgot why we went off on that. But.
So can you also
is there a correction to, you know, like the evolution I would do of these galaxies?
Very large masses.
Yeah, for ridiculously large masses, like supercluster masses.
So
the nice thing about it is there are actual equations, and there's, you know, a range of parameters where this happens, and not otherwise, and in the cosmological context, it requires ridiculously large masses. Plus, it would only happen, you know, where delta T is bigger than the appropriate scale, which for black holes is a Schwarzschild radius, and for this would be, you know, Hubble. And because of the why now problem, we're not really in that regime. So there are two reasons why it's consistent with cosmology. One is the why now problem, and the other is the giganticness of the detector mass that's required. If you take this.
You're telling me if I would just take some superclusters and evolve them for another 20 billion years, then there'll be some string stretching between them.
This would, if you have such massive objects, could become an issue in the far future, but not at the
in 20 billion years. I mean, not in some
20 billion,
entropy time or something, just in the Hubble time.
Well, so 20 billion is a factor of, you know, less than two, right? So maybe that's good.
How many Hubble times?
Yeah, whatever. In spirit, I agree. But it's not a practical constraint at the moment.
As the boost becomes larger, the strength of the effect decrease or increase in strength?
The most clear derivation we have of it would have it decrease for its own reasons, which you and I, we have talked about. So
is there any version of this where there's a large effect at any time, like if G string is small? So something like a firewall or some dramatic effect in the...
It's not dramatic like a firewall. That's true, unless the Hawking particle can sense it in a different way, which is one of the next steps. But it's still distinct from effective field theory.
So what happens from the point of view of a regular observer, some guy with constant acceleration, and he sees stuff falling through its apparent horizon?
You want to set it up so that there's some third party who's watching this, sitting?
Yeah, you have some the WITS detector, and he's watching stuff falling through its own apparent horizon. Will he see some sort of stretching as he sees things falling through its horizon?
I'm still trying to catch up to this setup. So we have an early probe and late probe, and actually it requires that late probe to shoot off some other secondary detector, so that it's a lot. We need all of that to even have this effect. Now you're adding somebody else. I'm sorry, doing what again? Is the person you're adding the detector of the spreading, or are you adding somebody else?
Maybe you could draw a picture.
Maybe I'll ask you.
I'd love to hear what you are asking.
Maybe I'm confused here.
Yeah. I wonder, there were a couple of other things that were put up to, Thomas had more to say on finishing his talk, basically. And I guess Atsushi, do you want to?
Okay, so I can try, yes.
There was a question of this inner product.
Inner product. Scribble down some things there.
Unless people have more pressing things that they would like to hear. But there's a couple of suggestions.
I would like to hear more about this non-locality. I'm not sure.
You mean the
we might have a talk about this. Or
yeah, there's going to be a talk in theory there.
I think Douglas had some comments about Boltzmann burners.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
What are we with?
I guess the only
stuff is a bit about DSCFT, a bit about both.
Yeah.
And Hawking.
Okay. You want to take 10 minutes or something?
Yeah, maximum. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I wanted to say something more about the complex structure of those Hartle-Hawking saddle points. So this is not in the context of false vacuum derivation. It's in the context where we might hope to preserve somewhat of a manageable asymptotic structure. But this is the context of, say, chaotic inflation. So we have these various saddle points starting at various places of the hill, and the geometric representation that I gave of those saddle points yesterday was essentially a geometry which is complex, where the deformed foursphere goes over in an inflating Lorentzian. But really, what are these solutions? These are complex solutions of the Einstein equations, and we can think of those solutions in the complex time plane. Let's just do no fluctuations so far. So we have these solutions are complex solutions for a scale factor and a scale factor with regularity conditions at the sub. That particular geometric representation of that complex solution is one along which we connect the solid pole to our boundary configuration, and let's be explicit about it now, a boundary value, a real value of the scale of the complex function A, boundary value B, and a real boundary value of the complex bulk scale of field phi, chi. That's our boundary condition.
Wait, why don't you pick up that, if you could, the microphone.
Oh. Okay, so.
You don't have to repeat it.
And then, these are the two boundary conditions that are behind those saddle points. But that particular geometric representation of the saddle point is a representation along a particular contour in the complex time plane. It's a representation where we go first this way and then up. Along this part of the contour, the geometry is approximately Euclidean and complex, and along the vertical part of the contour, the geometry is approximately Lorentzian and real. And the Euclidean action that I wrote down yesterday has these essentially two contributions. It's complex, of course, the Euclidean action, but this, its real part comes mainly from the first branch of the contour, and its complex, then its phase, mainly comes from the second part of the contour. So that's the story I explained yesterday. But there's a cute different contour which runs the following way, which runs this way. Along which the geometry of this particular solution also has a nice representation. And the distance between these two contours is roughly pi over 2 times the value of the potential evaluated at the field of the cell pole. And here the distance between these two guys is pi over 2 h, where h is set by the value of the cosmological constant all the way at the bottom. And along that contour, precisely because these are complex functions, the geometry of the saddle point looks very different along this first part of the contour, so A and B, say. Along the first part of the contour, the geometry is that of a Euclidean, an approximately Euclidean ADS region. It's an ADS domain wall, because the scalar field, of course, evolves, rolls in its potential along the ADS domain. And then the horizontal part of the second contour connects that Euclidean ADS domain wall through a complex region onto the final real boundary configuration.
Part you're going up in time, so the first part is Lorentzian time, is that right?
Here?
Yeah.
No, it's Euclidean, it's a Euclidean ADS domain wall.
Before that, you're asked classical from there, so that was the Lorentzian.
It looks like it's going
up. That's right, it goes up, but we're shifted, huh? So generally, the solutions are those, roughly speaking, those kind of metrics. And what's happening here is that this is minus dt squared, and this is some cosh squared. What's happening here is that this is minus dt squared, and this is minus sinh squared, roughly speaking. So you have a Euclidean ADS domain wall, in which the scalar field moves in an effective potential, which is minus the original potential. That's evidently why the ADS behavior. So why am I saying this? It's not any more illuminating for as far as doing cosmology with it, but it leads to a cute way, an alternative way to calculate the action of our boundary configuration, which is all we care about. The action defines for us the amplitude, and that's what we're interested in.
Yeah, the action is the same, right? You can compute this.
Yeah, exactly. The action is the same. Sorry. Yes, of course. Yeah. The action is the same. And so what happens is that along the vertical part of this second contour, the action IA, say, is minus what we call in Euclidean ADS CFT, the regularized dominant wall action plus what we call in the idea CFT, the counter terms. And the action of this complex bit from there to there, so IB, is minus the counter terms plus I times the counter terms. In other words, it's purely local, independent of the specific state or of the physics in the interior. And I wanted to say this to connect to what, a little bit to what Juan was saying earlier this week. So we have this is, in this specific context, restricted context, of course, because all this business assumes we have a kind of reasonable asymptotic structure. So that's why I'm working in a case without tunneling and so forth. We assume we have this kind of rigid structure. But it does say something. It means that the Hartle-Hawking wave function in cosmology is that there's an alternative way of thinking about it in this restricted context in this way. In other words, viewed from an ADS perspective, we're interested in...
Before that counter turns, it's even
I, yes, counter turn.
Yeah. Okay. I want to stick to just this branch for now.
Okay.
Then I want to make a connection with holography.
Okay.
So this branch, because this from there to there, it's universal. I can calculate probabilities for cosmological histories doing an Euclidean ADS calculation, right? And this construction applies to all saddle points, for all boundary data, also inhomogeneous saddle points, highly inhomogeneous saddle points, everything. This thing is purely a consequence of what we of a complex extension of Pfeffer-McGrahan type of analysis. We can use the Pfeffer-McGrahan expansions to conclude that this action integral is pure universal. So that opens up the possibility to calculate probabilities for cosmological histories by doing a Euclidean ADS calculation. But what are we? What are we having on the Euclidean ADS side?
Excuse me. In the left-hand picture, this has some sort of semi-classical interpretation, at least for some time, right? You can view that as a, you know, normal Lorentzian evolution, right? And the WKB approximation is valid. So how should you see the right...
This is a representation of the saddle points in which the classical behavior, the oscillating feature of the wave function, are totally obscure till you hit the final boundary.
So in particular, the WKB approximation is never valid in this geometry, or...?
Well, it depends what you mean by WKB.
Well, because I thought
function,
that...
The wave function, we always assume, we're calculating saddle points, so we always have the same classical wave function.
Yes.
But along this... No.
So the picture of time was emergent when you have some relation between the amplitude and the phase.
The way to detect whether this particular final configuration will evolve classically, do with the interior structure of the saddle point. This wave function is a function of real data, B and chi, so is, and when you calculate whether that configuration will evolve classically, all you need is the action evaluated at real boundary data. So it's not obvious that, This is a different representation of the same saddle point, and I can do the same physics with it. It just doesn't connect to our usual picture of classical evolution, because I've chosen my saddle point to represent my saddle point in a different way. All right, now I want to make my point. So look at this wave function. Look at what we have. What I wanted to say, look at what we have here. There we have, at that point, we have something like that. we have, in other words, the decaying wave function in areas, which is very unusual and very different from what we usually have in Euclidean area CFT. With the De Witt equation, we'll have such a potential and will asymptotically be generically have a growing term plus a decaying term. And usually in Euclidean area CFT, we do a regularization procedure to calculate these things, and we're interested in that finite piece of the wave function. But there's something more going on. If we're interested in calculating the Hartle-Hopkin wave function in cosmology, which is appealing because it puts the fluctuations in the ground state, then we somehow have to learn about how to extract or how to have access to something we don't usually consider in area CFT, because we calculate in the large scale factor limit, and then this thing disappears. You might say, well, why don't we turn things around? Why don't we take this thing, the growing wave function in the AES domain, and work our way backwards? What do we get in cosmology? Well, we do get a well-known wave function in cosmology. You do get a tunneling wave function. You do get, in the Wheeler De Witt picture, now in cosmology, you do get the tunneling wave function which decays across the barrier and then oscillates, in contrast to the Hartle-Hopkin wave function, which does this. But the problem is that you do get a tunneling wave function, and therefore appealing high probabilities for long periods of inflation, because psi t will be like that. But you do get a tunneling wave function with the wrong sign for the fluctuations. Remember, there's this very complicated story in the context of the tunneling wave function that they have one sign for the backgrounds and a different sign for fluctuations. So you might think, well, what does Euclidean area say? Yeah, I'm about to say this. It doesn't come out right, because it's the entire action, including the one for the fluctuations, which reverses the sign. So we never get it right, and I'm not sure what to think about this connection with Euclidean area safety fundamentally. I find it neat. It emerges automatically without additional continuations or whatever. It emerges from the complex structure of the saddle points. And it allows for you can replace the irregularized action by a QFT action evaluated on the final boundary, conformal boundary, and some sort of conformal free scaling of the scalar field. It provides you with an alternative way to calculate these saddle point probabilities in principle, in restricted models, of course, where you have a well-defined de Sitter asymptotic structure.
Thomas, so there's something I'm confused about with this picture. B and chi could be the values of B and chi now, right? We're computing the wave function for the scale factor today.
Yes.
And so you're saying all, from this point of view, all of history is an illusion, right? Because it's all this complex, nothing to do with usual Lorentzian evolution. Yes, so yesterday is a fiction, in some sense, from this point of view.
In a calculation, in some sense.
Well, okay. Yep.
Because then I calculate my wave function, and I deduce what the wave function today would predict for the past. I could evolve it back and forwards, classically, if my wave function allows it. So this
We got here from, if we got here from the pink trajectory, then yesterday is an illusion.
Oh, no, but this is just the way to evaluate the saddle points. Right. There's a distinction I always make between the saddle points and the actual histories that we create.
So the history does have a past singularity, right, in general?
Ah, yes. If you were to calculate the Lorentzian history starting from the amplitude you get there, as long as you're in this regime, you're allowed to do this. And then you'll never run into a singularity.
Right.
Okay, so you can evaluate the wave function at various values of B and go down. Okay? And so then you would essentially trace our classical history. That would be a classical history derived by evaluating the wave function at various times, and it would follow exactly a classical trajectory until you get into this complex region of the saddle point where this condition fails and it's genuine will of the wave evolution that takes over.
Right, but for that you need the UV information about the theory, right?
Yes. Sure.
Why?
Or no. Why?
Well, yes and no. It depends on what stage you're working.
Well, I thought so because how else would you understand what's going on in that strongly curved region? I mean,
you would do this path in a row. It's not strongly curved. It's Hubble scale curvature.
Wait. No, I mean, I'm sorry. I was asking about the Lorentzian evolution backwards in time. So this constructs a state, I understand that. Now take that state.
When the universe gets Hubble scale, then he says you should stop thinking about the Lorentzian evolution.
No, does he say that?
That's what I say.
No, but okay, we're just repeating the discussion from before.
I think an important point to make is that the geometry of the saddle points is not the physical geometry, Lorentzian geometry, any more, for example, than if you calculate the ground state of field theory, the Euclidean configuration of the field is the actual Lorentzian field configuration.
No, it's not. Exactly. It's not the Lorentzian field configuration.
So the wave function is the same in both of those, but they have different complex representations, right? Then you take the wave function, look at its semi-classical form, and calculate the Lorentzian.
Eva is interested, so to speak, in the wave function at small values of B. Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm saying there's some system that for which you've constructed a state, if I understand correctly, at some late time in an expanding universe. So I'm just asking if in that universe, in just real time, you evolve back, can you evolve back in time to where the densities become Planckian and you need the UV theory?
Well before that regime, at lower curvatures, or the theory with which we're working would tell you that it is that you're not justified evolving classically backward in time.
What characterizes the moment in which you break down?
The local horizon scale.
Well, maybe we're saying
so this is another sort of piece of information that classical GR effective field theory breaks down on scales. Well, before you reach the Planck scale, this is the typical scale when the entire universe becomes of the horizon size.
It's where you hit the turning point, is what you're saying.
Where Lorentzian classical evolution is no longer justified from a wave function viewpoint. So that's the ingredient we're offering here, right? We work with a wave function, therefore we have a framework to detect. So detect whether classical Lorentzian GR evolution emerges as a prediction or not. And we find that it does not emerge until the entire universe is one horizon size.
So Steve just informed me that actually you're talking about a state which if you evolved it back, it's got mild enough perturbations, if any, that it actually realizes a de Sitter bounds. Is that?
Kind of. That's because.
So that means there wasn't a singularity, but you can evolve it back in time.
Yeah, it depends on where I start. But if I start sufficiently high at the South Pole here, then indeed, you're well into. You're right, Steve. Then the state is very time symmetric. Yes. That's because we put the fluctuations. They also obey a regularity condition, right? Markle Hawking. What does he do? It imposes boundary conditions in the middle.
Symmetric, it's perfect,
The bottom line. Right?
But if you ping it late and then run it back, bad stuff will happen to you or something.
If you perturb.
Yeah, if you perturb it late and then run it backwards.
Oh, yeah, so from that viewpoint,
you're choosing to work with a state which has this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You should think of Harlow Hawking as imposing boundary conditions in the middle of the city, essentially.
Okay.
So what you get is two kind of time-reversed copies.
And if you look at the fluctuations...
Same thing.
Sure, yeah.
So I wanted to say one more very small thing. You could then ask the question within this context again, but there is this picture of chaotic eternal inflation up here, which purportedly also generates a rather wildly inhomogeneous structure asymptotically. So if you then go through this entire construction and look at this partition function, has a term which is the conformal coupling term to the boundary, the conformal boundary geometry, that which suggests that if you make your asymptotic structure too inhomogeneous and include yielding an asymptotic metric which deviates too far from the round tree sphere, you may run into problems. This is all very nice as long as you're on the round tree sphere asymptotically, or as long as the curvature is greater than zero. Then, in fact, that term enhances the convergency of the field theory partition function. But if you buy that eternal inflation picture in this particular context, and you generate locally negative and locally positive curved patches and so forth, this is unlikely to converge. Which means, in this picture, that the same classical probabilities are perhaps more suppressed than you might have naively thought. Because if this diverges, it's e to the plus the regularized action that enters, which is 1 over z, and the diverges z would kill off those probabilities for wildly inhomogeneous configurations. So who knows? Maybe there is something to a more IR-regulated version inspired by holography, or a version or a framework in which the final dual theory, what I would say, automatically traces over final configurations that are too inhomogeneous. So that's what I wanted to add as of yesterday.
Any other comments or questions on that?
Can I ask a very annoying question? So, assuming I want to use your proposal to make a prediction, and assuming I know my potential, which is similar to what you've drawn here on the right-hand side, has a slow roll eternal inflation region, but on the left-hand side has a vacuum back-end tunnel into this. Okay? So, assuming our data is perfectly consistent with the middle minima you are drawing there, so we are there, but it has two possible paths.
Ah, okay.
One is from a tunneling.
Yes.
Another is from this slow roll eternal inflation.
Like this?
Yes. And given the current data, I ask you to predict which one is the case, which one is our past.
Yeah.
Is it possible to...
The prediction that I made yesterday, we weigh these two different eternal inflation patches. Essentially, my proposal yesterday came down to weighting these two by their relative entropy.
And you're saying if the lower one has lower vacuum energy, you will predict that is the favorable.
My weighting factor was e to the pi over v evaluated at the eternal inflation threshold. That's just the entropy weighting. That's what comes out of the power of the. So if the threshold for eternal inflation is here and there, then we predict CL is associated with the local universe and whatever happened here,
so you'll be saying that if there are a lot more possible channels to go in here, you predict that we're coming from the lowest possible something.
That's right. lowest possible eternal inflation
actually. Lowest possible eternal inflation.
Leads to a universe with structure time.
Yes. And if you have a lot of other force vacuum, you will most likely select the lowest one, because any force vacuum is eternally inflating if it's not towing.
So those
most of the force vacuum will be eternally inflating.
Yeah.
So you select that. Our parent vacuum is the one with lowest possible CC.
As I said in the example yesterday, about the D-brain inflation example, then in fact, I don't think you have this force vacuum. In that case, we didn't find a single realization of eternal inflation, which was of the false vacuum type, in that particular coronal landscape. All the eternal inflation realizations that we found were of this inflection point type. And in fact, there are fewer and fewer if you lower that inflection point. So you got to do more and more realizations and simulations. But so we're driven towards the rare, low-lying eternal inflation patches in the landscape. And as Eva pointed out, therefore, to the prediction that the tensor to scalar ratio should be very small. I'm happy to bet.
So that means you believe, no offense, Jim, but you believe the Hartle-Hawking wave function. Because what you're testing is a combination.
Do I have to express my belief in the bet? I'm happy to bet that the Hartle-Hawking wave function predicts a low tensor to scalar ratio.
But then are you betting that that's what will be seen?
Sorry? Below the level we'll be able to
do that. So what you're testing is a combination of that wave function and the theory of the landscape, which and all you need for that is that it includes low energy, eternally inflating regime, regardless of what else is possible.
Exactly. Yeah. And as I verified, even just in deep inflation, you have that. We found it.
To verify that, you really need to make sure the 700, higher dimension operators that are canceling deep inflation will do that for you. But
yeah, we found it at the level that Liam found.
Okay, good. So
26 terms, right?
Huh?
Well, 26 free coefficients.
Can you count of order 700 operators?
Yeah, well, that is your close higher terms.
No, it was like 700 operators that matter, because it's not just. Usually it's plus press operators, but there's a lower scale involved, and so it.
Yeah.
Okay, but anyway.
That's all that'll be
fine. Okay, but you're testing that combination.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
But my question is, why are you so sure that the right wave function is, again, apologies to Jim, but the right wave function is that wave function? That just continues to seem to me to be quite a strong assumption to make.
Well, okay, so maybe I should have concluded with that yesterday. So for two reasons. Without any conditional waving, Hartle-Hawking is essentially an entropy-based waving of very specific regimes. That's the e to the plus 1 over v at the south pole. So it's a kind of natural measure of the very particular background. It has a potential microscopic interpretation because it's essentially making by the entropy. And second, the reason that I'm not prepared to give it up yet is that when we finally figured out to properly take into account our observational situation, it selects, again, it restricts to eternal inflation patches, so that's very similar, in fact, what you were saying. And again, those various eternal inflation patches are then entropy-based weighted. And it's not so obvious to me that this is going to be in contradiction with observations. In other words, when we took properly into account observation situations, we did not end up with a minimal 50 or 55 or 60 e-folds required for our existence. No, we got a lot more e-folds, which brought us in kind of safe domain. We're very far away from the kind of cutoff region in this framework.
So you're saying it could have failed.
These are the two reasons.
Like it could have failed, but it interestingly did not fail.
That's right.
Okay, well, it seems to me really interesting that if on the other hand there's a detection, you have ruled out one or the other, you know, the combination. If you're that's really true.
Yeah.
You
know. I'm much for this because this, once you're beyond this kind of thing, you're into predictive framework, and that's one prediction that comes out, this low bar.
I think the main problem with this formula is that it predicts we should be Boltzmann brains.
Ah, but this I leave to Douglas.
I think that was his comment.
So how about you asked this question often.
Very smart now that we meet him.
Can I ask something? So if I'm not mistaken, I learned this from Dan, that somehow kappa should be negative, right? So can you say something about kappa in this framework?
About
kappa?
Well, no, we can't, because here we have saddle points describing, these are Hawking versions of the Kolmogorov-Ruzsa asymptote. They describe open universes, so they're... But then the guys, the saddle points here, describe ghost universes, so...
But probabilistically, can you say something?
No, not unless you make it very specific your lens.
Okay.
In the particular context, yeah, that I think I mentioned this, right? In the particular context of T-brain inflation, we're currently investigating whether there is, in fact, whether brittle force vacua are possible there. It doesn't look like so.
What is getting a little late, so maybe we should continue other discussion more informally. One suggestion for that, for those who are interested, I think Atsushi has a few words about the question of squaring the wave functions that people could ask him about.